The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Before we begin the event, we wanted to welcome the poet Miriam Harris. She has a poem that she is going to read to you tonight. She is a local poet and teacher, and she has been selected by Patrice to present to you. Please welcome Miriam Harris.
Good evening. As was stated, my name is Miriam Harris. I am a local poet and a sixth grade creative writing teacher in Philadelphia. Thanks, I really appreciate that. I'm from Baltimore, but I've been in Philly for a while doing sort of activism work and things like that. So I just have two poems to share for you this evening before we get into our feature, if that's okay. This first one is called God is a Black Woman, because duh. My grandmother has a house full of other people's belongings, her basement alone a fortune, memoirs and trash all stacked to her ceiling, and we ask who made her house a museum, and she say, everybody. We ask who still come around, and she say, nobody. Everyone lived here once, where the house was a different kind of full, before the hostas began to wilt, where I could hide in the rose bush, and all the cuts were on accident, and the joy was palpable. These rooms loud and hot and everybody fed. I never knew that house, that laughter, or the pink of my grandmother's tongue. Only knew my grandmother angry and wanting to give up when she told us that we had been dumped on her too, like the trash in the basement. Our rooms filled with someone else's abandoned joy, so I grew into a keeper of my own kingdom. I put a castle and filled it with my loved ones, my apartment where everybody lived once. Bedroom and living room all filled to the brim, till my sanctuaries be riddled with waste and I clean it out. Struggle to recall what is actually mine. Funny how the giver cannot lay claim. Oh, the ways we become that what we thought we'd escaped. Oh, the God we damned and come to be. Whose church is this, which has become my burden? Who flooded this holy ground, made a tomb of my home and a drowned God of me? God is a black woman. I learned this when they came to me hungry, and I gave them myself. Laid down a bed where there was none, crafted a home from nothing, and asked for nothing. God is a black woman. In heaven is a crowded house in North Philly, whose foundation is rocky, and the roof is leaking, whose door is always open, but she never stops giving until her grace is worn thin, and the hostas wilt, and they uproot the rose bush to spite the thorns. She will fill her temple with screams, and they will run, because they have never known a God to cry for help. But wasn't it a black woman who taught you to worry and then told you not to? Didn't you dress me in your burden and have the nerve to call yourself carefree? Look how I turned water into whiskey, turned a trap house into a halfway home, took a minimum wage and fed a village. Look how my people would burn that village to the ground the moment I stopped giving. You think my grace infinite? Every time my stretched hand come back to me with gashes, my long arm still unfolding, my name spat up like bile, and they crow like they ever been crucified, like they live in the ruin. I know God is a black woman, and everyone else is a gaping jaw, either sucking my tit or cursing my name. Either way, I make sure their mouths stay full. Thanks. And to get it poppin', this next one is called Fuck White Feminism. Cool. Glad you brought me, aren't you? All right. The nation's capital becomes a room barren of black women, and white girls don't notice any difference. They go on with their signs, screaming at no one, singing in the name of no one. White women, best at filling the room with sound and then swallowing their voice just in time for a black girl to need it. Ask what I expect from them. Say they're in danger too. Say they are silenced too and don't have enough hands for the both of us. White women with a scalp full of my hair. White women who claim to bite back but have a mouth full of my teeth. They speak with my tongue and tell me they don't have time to address every issue. Tell me the fight for freedom is not an easy one when I was born with bloody knuckles. Tell me to march for their cause when I was born with my ankles bound and I still find time to raise their children and clean their home, be fucked by their husband. A white woman puts her hand over my mouth and demands that I put her in office after she got rich by binding me in her closet. A white woman led me to the polls by my neck and still lost in November. White women shot themselves in the foot, then demanded I carry them on my back. A white woman clothed my body even after she has killed me. A black girl is found in a freezer and white feminists are silent. A black girl is found in a river and white feminists are silent. Thousands of black girls are never found and white women are silent. A cop pulls a white woman over and she's nervous. He tells her not to worry. Says we only shoot black people, and even if he is joking, even if he doesn't kill me, I still want to die, and that is the laugh itself. White women are necromancers. Can't you see how she pulled the face from my dead auntie and called it fashion? Took the tongue from the mouth of a gone black woman. A white woman swears she can bring anything back to life. Anything but me. Thank you.
Thank you, Miriam. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am honored to introduce our guests this evening. Last February, Sabrina Fulton and Tracy Martin came to the library to speak about the devastating loss of their son, a loss that inspired outrage and a call for social change by one of tonight's guests, which led to the birth of a nationwide movement. Patrice Kahn-Cullers is one of the co-founders with Alicia Garza and Opal Tometi of the Black Lives Matter movement. She is an LA-based artist, activist, and advocate for criminal justice reform, a Fulbright scholar, a 2015 NAACP history maker, and one of Fortune's 2016 World's Greatest Leaders. She'll be joined tonight by co-author Asha Bandele, a former features editor for Essence Magazine and senior director at the Drug Policy Alliance. Ms. Bandele is the author of the memoirs The Prisoner's Wife and Something Like Beautiful, as well as two poetry collections. Their new book, When They Call You a Terrorist, is an impassioned rebuttal to those who call Black Lives Matter a threat to America. Michael Eric Dyson praised the book for portraying the movement's genesis in love, love of self, community, people, and ultimately the very soul of a democratic nation. Tonight, they will be in conversation with Philadelphia's own scholar, professor, and journalist Mark Lamont Hill, who currently serves as the first Steve Charles Chair in Media Cities and Solutions at Temple University. He is also the author of the widely praised book, Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable from Ferguson to Flint and Beyond. Please welcome Patrice Kahn-Cullers, Asha Bandele, and Mark Lamont Hill.
Good. It's fancy, right? Good evening, everybody. Man, first of all, it's so wonderful to see all of you here this evening. And I like y'all and everything, but I am super excited to see these two. These are literally two of my favorite people in the whole world, and I couldn't imagine being anywhere else right now than with you two and with this amazing book. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Of course.
Really excited to be here. Who is the young woman who is reading poetry?
Exactly.
Can I see you?
At?
Where are we
who
at, Marion?
Stand. Okay, she well, did? Well, when she steps back in. Yes. My, can we give another round of applause? My God. She brought that whole thing.
Yeah, that was stunning. And so appropriate for this night and for this book. whenever I talk to people about their books, I always, the first thing I always ask is, why this book, why now? Can you talk a little bit first, you, Patrice, about why this book, why now?
Yes. I'm super grateful to be in the room and glad that in this moment, given who is in office and the administration that he's assembled around him, that we still have it in us to gather in these ways. I think it's important that we stay in community, that we stay loving up on each other. We could talk politics all day, but there is a grief in the country and in the world because of America. And I think being close to one another and holding space for one another is just as important as trying to figure out what policies we're going to change. And with that, this book, for me, is an offering. It's also a truth-telling. And it's a reminder that Black Lives Matter isn't going anywhere.
That's right. The process of writing a memoir is daunting, I'm sure. I'm scared, you know? You wrote it now, and there's some people who would say, and have said, not about you, but in general, I'm gonna wait 10 years before I write this, and I'm gonna wait another 20 years before I write this one. You could have written a Black Lives Matter history, you could have written a cultural analysis, but what you do here, particularly in the first half of this book, is that you revealed the self. Did you have any angst or anxiety about doing that now at this point in your life?
Yes. And I still do. But, you know, a little bit about how we got to the process. I was asked, offered in 2015, someone saw me on a panel and said, you know, you got a book in you. And I said, okay. Cool. I don't know what that means. I also wasn't thinking about writing a book. I was in the daily grind of organizing and being on the front lines and trying to cultivate and support both the movement, but also Black Lives Matter, the organization. But when we started to be called terrorists, and when our movement started to clearly be surveilled, and when it looked like Trump was going to, in fact, really win the Republican ticket, I went to Dream Hampton and I said, should I write a book? You know, someone said about a year ago that I should write a book, and we weren't sure it was going to be a memoir, and she said, yeah, and you should talk to Asha. And I called Asha literally immediately. I hung up and I called Asha. I was like, Asha, what do you think? And she's like, oh, you should write a memoir. And it was like pretty much settled from that moment.
Wow. And the call to Asha, I mean, you all know Asha Bandele. First of all, is one of the great writers of our generation. And I really mean that. She's a writer, she's a poet, she's an activist, she's a Brooklyn... No one does more to sell Brooklyn to people than her. Like, she would have you think black
Brooklyn
people...
Brooklyn sells Brooklyn.
We have a Brooklyn-Philly rivalry. I love Asha to death, but she...
I don't have an apartment in Philly. You have an apartment in...
Perhaps Brooklyn, but... It's either here or... But what library are you at right now? The Philadelphia Free Library with the people. With the people. And one of the things, though, that Asha has done is, through her writing, her own, I don't want to call it confessional, it's a memoir, it's reflection, but in some ways it is a confessional space as well. You've modeled a certain kind of practice of revealing the self, risking the self, not for indulgence, but to open up a bigger question, whether it's mass incarceration, whether it's parenting, all these things. When you get the call from Patrice, what are you thinking?
That's a good question. You know, let me put a little bit more context on it. There were other things that were happening, and sometimes terrorism doesn't show up in a Donald Trump or in a military tank. sometimes it shows up at someone who's at our rally and takes credit for our work and erases the labor, the sweat, the pain, the history of Black women. It's why I was so moved, you know, by the poet. And surely, Mark, you know, that was what was happening with Patrice and Alicia Garza and Opal Tometi, the three Black women who founded Black Lives Matter.
Absolutely.
And what happened what happened in Ferguson a year after Black Lives Matter was founded was that NBC News decided one person was the spokesperson, a man who was not a member of Black Lives Matter. I'm not going to tell you he wasn't there. He was. We all saw him. We saw the vest. But he began to take credit for work that he didn't do. And not only was he taking, in many ways, credit for work that Alicia and Patrice and Opal had created, but also for the 80% of Black women who were on the ground in Ferguson, Black women who were trans, who had come from Ohio and risked their bodies to stand in unfamiliar streets where they didn't know how they would be welcomed. All Black women took a stand in Ferguson, 80%, just as it was during the Civil Rights Movement, just as it was to give birth to the Civil Rights Movement. And so, you know, it became important, you know, to your first part of your question, is that there's never a wrong time, really, for the truth, yeah. Right? Never really a wrong time to document history. And then, you know, in terms of this being more of a memoir, there's, you know, just two pieces to that. First, I think that there are a lot of people, including my own daughter, who feel very much a member of Black Lives Matter and will have their own perspectives. There had already been books out, your masterful take on much of what was happening in the world, certainly many books. And so I think that in having a subtitle, A Black Lives Matter Memoir, is a call to people to let 1,000 flowers bloom, tell all the stories. How many biographies do we have of Lincoln? Let's have a lot of stories, right? And, you know, the other piece is that we don't get to see people's humanity. We get to see caricatures. We get to see bots half the time. But Patrice's vulnerability in demonstrating that this was a human being that was being denigrated and having her work erased, and these were human beings who were murdered, somebody's child, was exceptionally important. And Patrice's ability to walk through fear and pain and relive a lot of trauma, was one of the most courageous acts I've ever had the honor to bear witness to.
Let's talk about some of those courageous acts in the book, particularly the first half. Again, your book for me stands in a tradition of powerful Black women, freedom fighters, who, as Asha points to, have found a way to tell their story without being narcissistic or self-indulgent, but to advance something bigger. Asada did that. Angela Davis did that, who wrote the wonderful foreword to this book, which you have to read as well. And then you're in this book, and you're risking the self to tell these stories. One of the things you talk about, first of all, is this relationship to your father. And I know it's a difficult thing to talk about. Can you talk a little bit about what that relationship was like and how that shaped how you understood not just yourself, but your relationship to the work you do?
Yes. I mean, I grew up with two fathers, one who raised me and was a big, masculine man, and then would cry at the drop of a hat. That's the kind of men I grew up with. And then my other father, who is my biological father, who I wouldn't meet until I'm 11 years old, I detail in the book, who is a recovering drug addict, and in his recovery became very central to how I understand my own vulnerability. There's a saying in 12 Steps, which is, you're as sick as your secrets. And my father, and his vulnerability, and in his rage, and his everything he was trying to figure out, really showed me the impact his own childhood had on him, showed me the impact being pushed into a certain type of masculinity and patriarchy had on him. And while it took a while for us to get to know each other, and he spent a better part of my years inside a jail cell, we really developed our relationship through letter writing, and when he would come home, spending lots and lots of time with my family. And, you know, there's something really special about being able to have a parent apologize and hold themselves accountable for the trauma that they may have created in your life. And there was, he became an example of what is possible for an adult, for a grown black man in particular. And he is a character in the story that you get to see all of him. And I think part of being black, you know, in America is we don't get to be vulnerable. That is a part, that's the part that gets sacrificed. And vulnerability is such a key thing if we want to heal and be whole. And that, you know, when Asha and I were developing the book, we had all these themes. Like, what are the major themes? And one of them is around healing justice. I didn't call it that as when I was younger, but I deeply believed in the need to heal, to also forgive, and in transformative justice, and the idea that maybe the system will never see black people as redeemable, maybe the system will never see us as human, but we can. We get to offer that to one another.
Was it one of the things that struck me in the book was, before you get to the stage of forgiveness, before you get to the stage of healing, there's this jarring interruption to your life. You just, like, he's just coming home.
Yeah.
I don't want to ruin the whole book, but I'm just really, I found that so stunning. Can you talk just a little bit about what that meant to have a yet another father figure emerge seemingly out of nowhere?
I wasn't interested, to be honest with you. I really liked my other father. He was fun and charismatic, and I always tell Asha if they met each other, they would like fall in love. They have very similar energies, just like super fun and super caring. And I had a very deep relationship with him, and I think in a way, I did become his favorite because he knew that I wasn't his blood, and he never wanted me to feel like I was something different. Mm-hmm. So we had this very, very particular relationship. And when my mother tells me I have another father, the sort of like rote response was to say, okay, I want to meet him, but I didn't actually really want to meet him. I wanted things to go back to the way they were. And so it was a challenge those first few years because I didn't call him father. I didn't feel like I was obligated to. He was a stranger. And I didn't know this new person. It was uncomfortable and weird. And you know, I think there's this idea that you have to be, you know, all those like Maury Povich shows where like adopted folks meet their family and they all run to each other and start crying. I thought that's what it was going to feel like, and it didn't at all. It was very confusing and disorienting. Well, what do we do now? You know, what do my siblings do? You're not there. I mean, it was just a very confusing dynamic, and it wasn't like someone was like sitting me down to be like, all right, how are you feeling? What do you need? It was just like, all right, go meet this dude, and y'all figure it out, right?
Asha, you have helped us both through your writing and through your activism and your policy work, think through the effects of mass incarceration and the drug war and all these other overlapping processes, how they affect families, how they tear families apart. I'm not sure we ever got as much insight from the world about how to put them back together again. Can you talk a little bit about those two things?
Let me see if I'm going to answer this correctly. I mean, I think that number one, we can look throughout the history of black people in this country and know that there's never been a guaranteed right to family. We've demanded it, We pulled it together. At the end of slavery, there's documentation of people walking barefoot 100 miles to find the families that had been taken from them, the children. And immediately post, we had a good 10 good years, I think, during Reconstruction. And then, you know, you had the Black Codes that began to separate families again. You had the rise of the Ku Klux Klan that drove domestic terrorism in the South and opened up a migration pattern that separated families again. And so we're in a new iteration of that. And I think that I, you know, the work that I do around the drug war is very much in response to honoring those who are not here anymore, because the drug war was is a proxy for a race war. It was started at a moment when Black people had achieved some of the greatest gains in this country in civil and human rights. And at that very moment, Nixon declares drugs the enemy, and he declares our communities the enemy zone. Of course, John Ehrlichman would say, did we know we were lying? Of course we did. But we did it anyway. And the worst part of it was that we bought into it. We believed the people we once loved, whether they were drug sellers or drug users, should be thrown away. We were silent when 2.2 million people went missing on our watch. We never questioned that more crack and powder cocaine was used in white communities, but they didn't fall apart because they had employee assistance programs and other things to hold them together. We just called people crackheads and dismissed them. I often have said, as Patrice and I have been talking, we can embrace a killer Mike on Bernie Sanders' political campaign, but if his name had been Crackhead Mike, we wouldn't have. And so we've participated, we who are not just Black but progressive, in writing off a whole generation, two generations at this point, of people, and has had an extraordinary impact on families, which is also the great importance of Patrice's story, is pulling that apart and demonstrating what Patrice has talked about, which is secondary trauma. And that, you know, when you disrupt a family, or, you know, one person, you put them in prison, the kind of trauma that that leaves children and others in is almost immeasurable.
You said something about throwing people away that I have found resonant throughout the book, and also throughout these last 3 or 4 years, really since Black Lives Matter has been at the forefront of our conversation. That's this idea of disposability. And it seems there's a way that we are willing to throw people away, not just people who are mass incarcerated, although we do, not just people who are addicted to drugs, not just LGBT folk, but even each other, even other activists. Even someone says something out of step, someone makes a mistake, we drag, we call them out, we throw them away. What do you attribute that culture, and how can we work through that? Because that seems to be a big thing, and it's something you've been resistant to. I mean, part of your work has been to say we can't throw each other away.
Okay. you know, we live in a culture that is a bullying culture, and we should know that. You know, I remember being a child in school, Mark, and learning about Pax Romana, and learning that there was 200 years of peace in the ancient Rome. And as a little girl, I thought, well, what's the big deal about that? You don't fight for a while. And then if we fast forward and think about America, you know, from the 20th century onward, when have we not been at war? Whether we were aware of it and it was declared, you know, through the first couple of world wars, the Spanish-American, I mean, just go on and on. The wars that were never claimed, the bombings that have gone on that we haven't talked about. And so embedded in this very culture is the idea of throwing people away. And now we've given, you know, sort of different platforms to turn up, as Patrice will, you know, we've experienced recently, and just, you know, dismiss people. And, you know, we're products of this society. We're product. You can't talk about the way we can. I don't believe we can talk about the way that any number of young activists behave when, in fact, they were thrown away, right? In fact, they were told they didn't matter. They were told it when they walked into school buildings that looked like prisons. They were told it when they had to go through metal detectors. They were told it when they didn't have adequate food, many of them. They were told it when they had teachers that didn't care about them, when they learned the wrong things. A boy in the ninth grade, 9 years old, being asked the other day, what are the three good things about slavery? They're told it. This happened. This happened last week. So we're constantly being told,
Jesus,
you're disposable. And so it's our job, and I want you to take it from here, really, Patrice, it's our job to disrupt that at every single turn, even when it's uncomfortable, even when, you know, you got to resist. I have an inner petty, and and I like holding a grudge. It feels good sometimes, but it's not actually, you know, what was going to get us free, and ultimately that's what we have to keep our eye on.
Yeah, I mean, I think over the last few years, what I've witnessed, specifically on social media, is we've used dragging culture. Anything can turn bad fast. But I think about the sort of like early days of Black Twitter that was really using dragging culture to challenge corporations,
right?
To challenge white trolls. You know, how many times did you get a death threat and you find that person on social media and you're like, you're silly, you didn't realize that you emailed me from your work email. let's email the company, like, which I think is a great way to drag.
Absolutely.
But when it turns into that is the way in which you relate to people, think there's becomes a culture where the dragging culture is almost like you get points for it. How well you turn up, how quickly you drag someone. And frankly, I don't think social media is a great platform to try to engage around some of these big issues. I think some of this stuff has to happen like this.
Yeah.
And I think we've really devolved in our ability to debate politically and to have some really rich political debates happened where folks were like, I don't agree with that. All right, let's duke it out on stage. Let's have a conversation about it.
Right.
And I wish we were there. I wish we could have a political debate without it turning into something, actual personal beef.
Right.
And I think we have to create that. You know, we have to be able to turn the culture around. And the way I do that, and some people don't like it, is I don't drag people. I don't drag Black people on social media. I won't. And I don't participate in it. And if I see people participating in it, I try to have a conversation with them. Can we do this differently? But I do think that when people feel like the only way they can get heard or seen is by turning up, it becomes hard not to do that. It becomes hard not to feel like that is your first response to something.
Yeah.
Mark, Patrice, I would ask you, like, do you think that, I mean, this is like a moment to imagine what success and winning looks like in a very different way, right? And I think it's not this one-upmanship, which comes also out of a culture of playing the dozens that was harmless at a certain point, but it's like, how do we imagine winning without harming someone else? And I don't think that we have a paradigm for that that we turn to, which is, again, what I think is so important in your story, you know, Patrice, is that winning looks different. Success looks different. We have to have new models of what success looks like.
And that's one of the things I want to ask you, because it seems to me that some of the one-upmanship is a very hyper-masculine and sort of patriarchal. Hey, I ain't got to agree that quick. All I heard was, But it's a very particular understanding of what leadership looks like, what activism looks like, etc. And so I think part of what your intervention did as Black Lives Matter, and even what you talk about in the second half of the book, the significance of three Black women leading this isn't just that we change the face of leadership, but there might be a new...
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that?
The how. And I've actually talked about this a lot, which is I'm not interested in getting somewhere and while I got there, I trampled on people. They trampled on me. We hate each other now, and now we have a new world, but we all hate each other. That's possible, right? I'm not saying that conflict isn't going to happen. I actually think conflict can be extremely generative, but I think we have to practice it that way.
Yes.
And we're used to getting upset or feeling some kind of way about something, and then it's a moral judgment on someone else. Instead, what I try to offer folks, and you have to be ready to do this, because sometimes this you could offer it prematurely, and I've definitely been in a dynamic where I'm like, okay, we're all going to do this mediated thing, and I'm like, oh, none of you actually want to do this.
Right.
Like, we have to want to forgive. We have to want to transform. We have to believe that it's possible, and we have to feel less interested in our ego's response, less interested in our emotional response, and think literally about what's bigger. And that's not to take away the impact it has on us. What I hope for is that we can get to a place where we hold ourselves accountable and people don't have to hold other people accountable. Think about that. Think about a moment when you have done something real terrible and you know you did, and you hold on to it versus going to the person or going to your staff or whatever and saying, I messed up. That wasn't acceptable. I'm really sorry. Is there something I could do? That's actually really liberating. It's really freeing. Yeah. But we don't live in a culture where we first take accountability. It often has to be someone else has to hold you accountable. And that's a hard dynamic.
Yeah.
Because we get into roles very quickly as humans, right? If you're the one that's always holding someone accountable, then that's right. The moment you step in a place, that's what you're thinking about. All right, who do I have to hold accountable here? So I just think that this piece around like being self-accountable is actually really critical.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Talk to me about, you know, I think about every freedom movement, and there's just this moment, every iteration of our freedom struggle, rather, there's a moment, something happens. And it's not necessarily something that hasn't happened before. You know, Emmett Till wasn't the first person killed, et cetera, et cetera. What was your moment of entry into this, and why then, do you think?
My brother was my moment. Mm. You know, I think, it wasn't something outside of me. It was cumulative and also a moment. And my brother is a victim of police brutality, almost was killed by the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department. And it was the brutality and the act against him that was so painful. But to be honest with you, what was even more painful was the aftermath. And we don't often talk about this. We talk about the moment someone's killed, or we talk about the moment someone's brutalized, but we don't talk about, what happens afterwards? Mm-hmm. And what happens to that person, what happens to the community, the family? And I saw the severe impact my brother's brutalization had on all of us. And what it did to my mother, who my mom was a teenage mom, and she was a single mother, and I saw what it did to me, to my siblings. And I think part of growing up poor and Black is not just being brutalized, but being completely neglected in the aftermath of it, right?
Yeah.
And I think that moment for me was my, oh, they actually don't care about us. And so what are we going to do? What am I going to do?
Hmm. Aisha, how about you? Because you've also been doing this for, you know, for a very principled reason. Can you talk just a little bit about what got you into this space and why you do what you do?
It wasn't initially as personal as Patrice has talked about, at least not as I initially perceived it. When I was in college in the very, very, very late 80s, very late, What was
December
happening?
'89 on the 31st.
What I'm trying to say, recognize. There were a couple of things that were going on. The dollar for dollar amount of money that was being taken out of public higher education was being put into the largest prison expansion New York had ever seen under a Democratic, under any governor, but in this case, a Democratic governor, Mario Cuomo. California would soon follow suit. He used the money to build prisons, circumventing the wishes of the voters who had said no on a bond issue to build prisons. And so instead, he went into funds that had been set aside on the day of Martin Luther King's funeral that was meant to build low-income housing and homes for poor people at the beginning of the Poor People's Campaign, and he used it to build prisons. And I was taking a course on black people and prisons, and I don't know that I didn't necessarily connect personally, I didn't think, to it, but I certainly knew, as somebody who had spent the earliest years of my life in foster care, what it meant to be set aside. I also knew what it meant to be claimed, because I have most incredible parents. And I think that I felt that when I started going up to prisons and teaching and visiting, and then, of course, you know, I fell in love with a man who was in a process of transformation, as I was in the process of transformation, and we got married. We have a beautiful daughter. She's sitting here in the front row ignoring us on her phone. But she's very brilliant, got accepted into Columbia University. I'm not bragging. Out of the most competitive pool of early decision applicants, I get to say the story my way because I got the mic. And so it was very clear to me when, you know, prisons, you know, they're hidden from our view, as Patrice talks about, you know. And when I went there, I was like, oh, damn, everybody here looks like people on my block. Right? These aren't people that fell out of the sky. These are people who look like my family. And in fact, they would become my family. I have family in prison, and after I wrote about it, and I would often ask, how many people have someone in prison, because this is now the late 90s, and nobody's actually talking about this stuff, you know, one hand would, like, slowly go up, and eventually you'd see the whole room. Like, no one gets out of this thing alive. No one gets out of it. And I just thought, you know, it's enough with chains. It's enough with disappearing people. And whatever I can do to impact that was what I wanted to do.
I've known you a long time, and I've known you not as long, but I feel like I've known you a super long time.
Is that another age?
I was there with you when I met you, so I'm just okay. Old.
Okay. Sensitive.
Yeah. No, I met Asha 12 years ago. She was 15 at the time. And,
why is that funny? I feel like this is a little rude. Is this Philly hate on Brooklyn?
But I met Patrice three years ago, probably this week or last week. Yeah, can you believe it? In Palestine, we went on a delegation to Palestine, Dream Defender delegation squad. So. And we got to spend a couple of weeks together, and I learned a great deal about you and your character, how principled you are. You don't know how to pack for the Middle East, but a girl from L.A. in January in Palestine with no coat, like, it's the Middle East, we good. Like, it was snowing. But one of the things that struck me when we were there and when I went back, Omar Barghouti, one of the leaders of BDS, said to me, do you all realize how significant what you're doing is? And then he specifically referenced you and said, please let Patrice know. I don't know if I told you this. I probably should have. This sounds important, right? He said, please let Patrice know that she is making history, that all of them are making history, and that the world is watching. And... all right. I don't know if you know that. She's one of the most humble people you'll ever meet as well. But do you ever take a moment to consider what this means in the sweep of history, the work you do, what this book will mean in the sweep of history. Do you think about that stuff? And how do you think about it, maybe?
Oh, Omar. I got to hit him up. That's really sweet and kind. No, I probably should do it more, and because I definitely encourage other folks who I think are doing amazing work that they should be patting themselves on the back more. And I think part of what's hard when you, I'll just start here and then go back to the question, which is, I wish Black folks were free. Mm-hmm. So while I'm proud of the work that we've done, I am, and I feel grateful for it. I'm still longing for something that doesn't exist yet. And I think that's just a contradiction that I sit with, you know? I'm longing for the day where I never have to visit a jail cell again because they don't exist anymore. I'm longing for the day where I don't feel scared when a cop car pulls up behind me because they don't exist anymore. And until that day, I think the way I sort of orient myself around the work is I just got to keep grinding. Mm. And so, but what I appreciate about that question is that it is really important that we claim our victories.
Yes.
It is very important for our morale, for our, you could clap on that. It's important for our morale. It's important for the work that we do. You know, the right claims everything. They claim their victories all the time. And so we have to, I think sometimes in our movement, we're a little bit too bent on perfection. But I do think it's no small feat that three Black women were able to galvanize the world around three words. So
you have changed the world, and you need to own and appreciate that. You have literally changed the world, and that matters. All of it does. Let's take some questions from the audience. Now, don't worry, I'm good. He was looking in the back, we gave him questions. These are from y'all. But if we have more, feel free. I think we'll have some time to take at least a couple more. Let's see here.
Red, black, and green. I just was not right.
That's how we planned it. Yup. One of the challenges of legitimacy that the BLM movement faces is a lack of recognizable leadership, a la Occupy Wall Street. How does a decentralized movement like BLM maintain cohesion and a unified voice? And is there a need for one?
Good question. Well, I will say that I don't agree. I think Occupy called itself leaderless. We call ourselves leaderful. Mm. And I think what people mean when they say it doesn't have a leader is doesn't have a Black male cis leader. Because I could actually point to, that's not shade. I just think part of how we orient ourselves around leadership in the Black community is a Black man who's usually a preacher. That has a really great orator. That's how we sort of orient ourselves around a Black leader. And very early on in the Black Lives Matter movement, we heard from, you know, Black celebrities and some folks in the old guard, like, don't mess with them. They don't know what they're doing. And they, what they were really saying is Black women don't know what they're doing. Don't listen to them. And I think part of what we have to do is reorient ourselves around how we understand leadership. Because literally, I talk to leaders of Black Lives Matter across the globe weekly. I know what they're doing. I know the work that they've done. I know how they're living. I know, and they're powerful leaders, and they're listening, and they're building strategy, and they're brilliant tacticians. So we've never claimed ourselves as leaderless. We've never claimed that we don't have leaders. What we've named is that we don't believe in the idea of one single charismatic leader that's going to take us to freedom. That's not how people get free. It takes all of us to get free. And it takes lots of different ideas about how we get to freedom. And I think that's what's actually most exciting for me about being a part of this movement.
Mark, let me thank you for that, Patrice. I just want to add to that because I couldn't agree more. And it's probably also instructive to remember that most people did not follow Martin Luther King. Most people did not follow Malcolm X. They let Betty Shabazz live in welfare and poverty, right? Coretta Scott King stayed in a broken down shotgun shack until Oprah Winfrey bought her a home. Most people did not think of SNCC as leaders. And so what I think too, Patrice, is that there's a lot of people who are afraid. And so when people put out a call to action, the way to get around actually having to do something is to stand on the outside and say, well, that's not real. There are no leaders. And I want to, you know, acknowledge something that I said the other day. When you put that call out, and I had already known you a couple of years, you know, at that point, even from the first time I met you, you made me braver. You made me want to work harder. You know, there's a way that you can go to a whole lot of meetings and you can have a lot of paperwork and do a lot of reports and get on a whole lot of conference calls and think that you're actually doing something. And the needle doesn't move at all. And so I think that I was in that, right? And it was good, and I said good things, but, you know, you made me work harder, think deeper, push more, imagine more. And I think sometimes when the pushback comes against the Black Lives Matter movement, it's because people are just cowards.
There is something to be, I agree with everything you just said. I also just wonder, though, if you were a cis hetero man. I mean, for example, wouldn't there be a lot more Black people in the room right now? I mean, it's fascinating. I love all y'all white people that came and going to buy this book. Two copies.
Like, reparations.
Yeah. But I'm serious, two. We got the answer for Trump. Maybe three. But, no. Just kidding. Two is fine. But, I was struck when I came out. Not by how many white people were here, which is awesome, but I thought I expected more Black folk in the community to come out, and I wonder how much of that is linked to the idea of Black women leading to just be illegible to us in so many ways that I find striking. I know we got to pivot because we got a couple more questions. Well, one question, ironically, is what can white people do to support your work? So, you got the first answer. But... there are some more substantive ways beyond that that we can get to. Can you both answer that question?
You know, I think that there's a lot of things, right? I mean, I think that there is really a reckoning that has to happen around Trump and the normalcy of white supremacy. I think that, you know, for many women who are white feminists, there's a lot of people in your own families you have to have the courage to speak to, like I had to have the courage to speak to my family, who were, you know, sort of middle class, you know, fairly socially conservative Democrats, about politics that were not the norm for them. They certainly didn't expect their child who graduated high school at 15 to come home and say, and this is my baby daddy who's in prison, right? But they were gonna have to learn how to deal with that. Mm. And I think to have those courageous conversations is pivotal, right? Not to just stand with white people who agree with you and who are progressive, but to have the kind of conversations we have with our own folks is important. And then some significant examples. I'll raise the name of Marilyn Buck, who drove the getaway car so that Sassada Shakur is now 38 years free. I'll raise the name of Laura Whitehorn, who did much time in prison.
Yes.
I want to raise the name of a man, actually whose name I don't know, but who protected, and I thought he worked there, Bree Newsom, when she climbed up that flagpole and took that piece down. I thought homie worked there. That was the whole point. He was just like, you ain't gonna hurt her on my watch. And they did it. And he didn't center himself.
That's why you don't know his name.
Right? He didn't say, let me tell you about like something that like really like totally bothered me though. You right? We don't know his name. He just did the right thing and kept it moving like the majority of black organizers do every single day. So those are some pieces that we can do. And you can first do this. Listen. Deep, profound listening, which Mark is what informed. You were asking about writing process before. That's what informed this book. A deep listening, a deep sharing, right?
Yeah. All of what Asha said, and I think for white folks in the room, join organizations.
Yes.
Join something. I think it's, you know, part of whiteness is to be very individual and to think that you could do everything on your own or you have the right solutions or answers to a thing. There's not so many conversations I've had with white people throughout the years are like, have you thought about doing this? And I'm like, are you qualified to ask me questions like that? So I would say join an organization and learn and be willing to learn under folks of color and people of color. And there's specific, I don't know if there's a Surge chapter here standing up for racial justice. Are you in the room, Surge? Yes! Okay, raise your hand if you're part of Surge. Raise your hand high. White folks, these are the white folks you want to talk to join Surge. And Surge is a group, white anti-racist organizers who are organizing white people. And I think that is some really important work to do. And I was a part of the first team of folks of color in Los Angeles that was working with a group of white folks called AWARE, Anti-Racist Whites Allies Everywhere, or something like that. It's long, but this team of folks have been such an incredible resource to Black Lives Matter locally and do everything for the Black Lives Matter chapter. And it's been such an important moment to see white anti-racist white folks really stand up for Black power.
I was just asking my friend here if there's an expression in English that I have it in Spanish, and it's just like, I take my hat off to you because I always admire leaders like you that have your feet on the ground, that are really good leaders, that are not full of ego, and that know the way of doing a work that is transformative, that is human, that is real. And I really take my hat off to you because I can feel it, I can smell it here. So thank you for that. And my question is, at the beginning of the conversation, you said that, you know, there was a moment, maybe still is, that surveillance was happening with Black Lives Matter. And we in the immigrant movement are suffering that right now, like several leaders have been taking around the country, and there's a lot of concern about that. Is there any advice that you can offer around that?
While you answer that, can you also, because I forgot to ask you this earlier, I got so wrapped up in all the other interesting stuff you were saying, talk about surveillance, not just of certainly activists, immigrant movements, immigration rights organizations, but also gangs. Can you add that piece? Because there's the war on gangs is also a critical piece, both earlier and now.
I'll start actually with the war on gangs, because I actually think it's part of what informs a type of surveillance that happens to Black communities and immigrant communities, specific immigrant communities, not all immigrant communities. And, you know, the war on gangs, raise your hand if you've heard of that term, war on gangs. Raise it high. Yeah. Now raise your hand if you've heard of the term the war on drugs. Right. So there's a difference there. And I think in a lot of ways, the last decade, there's been amazing organizing to popularize the war on drugs and the impact. The war on gangs is just as dangerous, not known as much. And it really was created both as an extension of the war on drugs, but also as an extension of surveilling our communities. And we often talk about surveillance in a way that separates us from remembering that the first surveillance tactics happened on Black people, right? Probation is surveillance. Parole is surveillance. And we can't separate that. But with the war on gangs, what ended up happening is essentially young people, mostly young Black men, turned into targets of local law enforcement under public safety. And gang members were labeled as domestic terrorists. Literally, that was the language. I'm not using hyperbolic language. Language, gang member equals domestic terrorist. And so they were seen as enemy combatants. And that's exactly how they were responded to. Hyper-criminalized, which meant the entire community was hyper-criminalized. Patrolling of neighborhoods, hour on the hour, helicopter policing. And this becomes very normal. I think in this fast forward, in this current iteration of surveillance, for Black activists in particular, many Black activists had their homes knocked on their door, FBI knock on their home doors. Mm-hmm. Many activists have had local law enforcement raid their homes, arrest them. And we're seeing this now, especially with the immigrants movement, high-profile leaders. It's really a target of leadership. And this is tricky because I remember in the beginnings of us being surveilled, the first time my home was raided, calling one of my good friends and being like, what are we supposed to do? And he said the best thing you could do, because you're probably not going to stop being a leader in this movement against law enforcement, right? Because one way you could do it is to fall back, right? So it depends on your own your safety. But you probably won't do that. So the best thing you could do is shout it out loud and make everybody know what's happening, and organize and build the movement stronger. It's our best defense against surveillance is us being aware that it's happening, us telling everybody else that it's happening, and us organizing so that we can be a stronger movement, because we can't get rid of surveillance in the most immediate. We can, it's a beast, but we can build enough of our capacity so that we can challenge it.
Can I just say something to that too, to add on to what you said, Patrice, too, and specifically about immigrant communities? I mean, I think that I love what you said about shouting it and making it larger. I think that one of the things that's been so dangerous in the surveillance of immigrant communities has been, it's not even a bifurcation, it's you know, been cut in so many ways. You know, I can remember when we thought that DACA was like a beginning point, not an end point, right? DACA throws away so many people, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you smoke a joint, you're not DACA, right? If, you know, whatever, you jaywalked, you don't make it onto that list. There's a certain person who can even be considered under that. The people who are considered for DACA need to raise their voices. And as well, all people who are in surveilled and attacked and assaulted immigrant communities need to speak for all people who were attacked in my neighborhood in Brooklyn, right? It was all Jamaicans and Africans and Haitians, and what just happened right now with throwing out all the Haitian and Salvadoran and Honduran people. If, you know, to something that you had said earlier, you know, Patrice, is that, you know, this is very much a movement that will succeed when we decide to love the people who nobody has decided to love before. And to honor the people who no one's decided to honor before. And if we don't do that, then nobody will. And if we make the choice, you know, there's something that a colleague and dear friend of mine talks a lot about that happened in the Lodz Ghetto, which was the largest ghetto outside of Warsaw during World War II. And it was producing a lot for the Nazis because they held them. And they thought they would survive. And then one day, as the Germans were losing the war, they said, give me, and they, you know, the Nazis had to provide them with a little bread, a little water, right? And one day they came and said, give me your children. And the leader, the Rebbe who was leading them, talked to the parents and said, sacrifice your children. It will save the many of us. And they loaded those babies and the elderly onto those buses, onto those trains, and they killed those people, those human beings. And by the time the Los Ghetto was done, there was almost no one left. Of course, they were all killed. They come for one, they come for us all, period. And either we stand for humanity or we don't. There isn't an in-between.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, we are out of time for this portion because we are now going to sign some books. Woo. And have some really good conversation.
How many books does everybody bring?
I think we have a good number in mind now. But I just have to say again, first, Asha, thank you for your tireless work advocating, fighting, defending, writing, thinking, planning, often not getting the credit, but still doing the work anyway. It matters. Everything you've done has mattered. And I'm grateful to know you, to be your friend, and to learn from you. Patrice, words can't describe how important you are to this moment, how important you are to me, how important you are to our struggle. And although you probably will never fully appreciate how special you are, I hope that this book gives people an insight into your journey, into your struggle, and into just how significant you are to this moment in history. And we will win. I have no doubt about that. I'm claiming the victory. But I need you to know that your work, your struggle, your sacrifice is a part of that victory that will come. So thank you. I love you.
You.
We love you. Now let's go sign some books. And
thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.